how much magic happens when somebody feels like they are not only exploring a tool or a platform, but they're seeing it as an avenue to bring more prosperity into their life, bring more creativity, bring more, like they feel empowered, they feel like they have superpowers. And that to me has like been the engine of our success so far, and I think will remain the engine of what creates a strong business around, you know, putting more power into people's hands.
You're listening to First Block, a Notion series where founders and executives from the world's leading companies tell us what it was like to navigate the many firsts of their startup journey and what they learned from that experience. I am Akshay Kothari, Notion's co-founder and COO. Today, I'm joined by Vlad Magdalin, co-founder and CEO of Webflow. Webflow is the leading visual development platform for building powerful websites without writing code.
Good to see you. Yeah, thanks for having
me. Thanks for coming. Welcome to First Block.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start at the beginning. I guess it would be great to just hear, how did you meet your co-founders?
So one co-founder is my brother. So I, you know, I've known him since he was born. He's younger than me by 4.5 years. My second co-founder, Bryant, when I was at Intuit, we created this, me and this other designer started this thing called Intuit Brainstorm, which turned into a legitimate business, like a SaaS-based business inside of Intuit. And Bryant was our first hire, first engineering hire. By the time I started Webflow, it was one of those like perfect timings where, hey, we worked together a ton in the past. You know, back end way more than I know, I'm able to sort of like lean into that area, and it was like the perfect combination. So three of us just off to the races. Initially, it was just my brother and I for a couple months. And then as we got some traction, convinced Bryant to join. So
I think a lot of people say it's actually harder to almost like, you know, co-found a company with your family or your close friends. Mm-hmm. I think when you look back at sort of the partnership the three of you've had, yep. I guess, is there a secret that you've had this healthy sort of relationship? Yep.
I think for us, trust was built in from the very beginning. One, you know, my brother and I always had like a great working relationship where he's like great at things that I suck at, and I'm great at things that he's not great at. The fact that we had a third person that wasn't in the family, so to say, almost became like, Bryant became more like a brother. Sometimes he's sort of referred to as the honorary Magdalene. And my brother became more of a, I became to see him more as a co-founder rather than a brother. So like the three of us kind of felt the same in terms of brotherhood or co-founders, where there was not really like a special treatment between like whether your family or your co-founder. And maybe it was that balance of having like this outsider that was not in the family that kind of created a strong bond between us. But it also depends on the sibling, right? Like I can't imagine starting a startup with my other two brothers.
Can you talk a little bit about the early days? Like you mentioned there were like very complementary skill set. Like mm-hmm. Can you expand on that? Like how did the three of you bring your different skill set? How did you sort of invest in each other?
I mean, it was we were building a product that Sergi was the, you know, as the product designer, as the main designer, he was the core customer. Like we were building a solution to get him to build really powerful websites without like a Bryant or myself or a developer in the picture. And so we had that core strength of somebody who really understood HTML, CSS, to a degree JavaScript, and was like thinking, how do you visually abstract this into a UI that other designers like himself would understand? Like I mentioned before, Bryant had this depth in backend scale and infrastructure. Like the previous startup that he helped co-found was one of the fastest growing startups in terms of like the amount of data ingested, how you really leverage compute and set up a server infrastructure to handle like large scale. And I had come from I was a 3D animator and kind of a designer that had this, but I switched to programming. So I had this like really heavy front end lean that respected design and respected how hard it was to build kind of the back end side of things. And it was just this perfect combination of, well, you're an expert in this, I'm an expert in this, you're an expert in this, and just like, let's run. And I think the first 6 months we were at this place called the Hacker Dojo in Mountain View. Oh, it's just that. Like, yeah. The three of us sitting around a table and like, you know, 95% of the time, like heads down, either designing or coding. But the times where we would sort of like take our headphones off and, you know, spend time together, like reconciling something or debating something, just felt like there was like this natural both inclination towards our strengths and also this natural tension between everyone had an opinion about everything else.
You came to the US as a refugee when you were 9 years old. Can you talk a little bit about how that sort of impacted your founder journey?
Yeah, it's honestly, it was just the combination of 1,000 different events that were just all, you know, in hindsight, seem like blind luck from how that entire journey happened. But I think it, the most important thing is it gave me this perspective that life was so much worse, or would have been so much worse, where you know, where I would have grown up. This was like southern Russia, back in the USSR still, that I kind of have nothing else to prove, right? So it's not like I had a chip on my shoulder that I want to start like a large company or do something to like make a name for myself. I already felt that I've been incredibly lucky to be saved from like the life I would have had back in Russia. Like, it gave me this perspective that like everything is kind of upside. It also, because of the way that, you know, my parents were very poor, but they lost half of their earthly possessions moving over here. It was kind of like lost in the air travel here. Half of our luggage was physically gone when we landed. And, you know, went through like multiple years of my parents trying to learn English, being on welfare, trying to find like some way to make a living. And through that, it really built up this work ethic that you kind of just had to like pitch in and figure out how to help the family. And that just taught me that just the value of hard work.
Incredible. I resonate with a lot with that because I didn't have nearly as hard as that. But I think a lot of the sort of like good fortune of being able to come to the US mm-hmm. is very much shared, yeah. I think. Yep. So let's talk about, I guess, the early days of Webflow. I think one thing that I read that was super interesting is that it actually took you like 10 years and like 4 attempts to actually get it up and running.
Yeah, this final attempt, hopefully final, yeah. Took many different tries. And I think it was just a matter of timing and circumstance. You know, the first time I tried to start it just by myself, while still in college, this was around 2005. Then I had a couple other attempts while sort of not like moonlighting or almost planning to leave full time. One of those got raised, you know, not insignificant funding. It was like, at the time it was like 50K, but it felt like a lot of money to start a real attempt. This was different co-founders, but for various reasons, all three just either didn't work out or just took too long to like get to some sort of traction where I kind of lost momentum or people left or I had, you know, had significant life events like kids being born and getting married that took my attention off. Sometimes it was like competitors coming in that I got discouraged. Other times the technology wasn't quite ready. We had built something, but it wasn't quite, like in 2007, we built something that, was directionally what Webflow ended up becoming, but it was more like backend oriented without like the visual front end pieces. Just because browser technology wasn't there yet to even imagine building something like what Webflow ended up becoming. It was a, you know, it was a lot of different shots on goal that ultimately, all the pieces ended up coming together again in 2012, which is when this last attempt started.
Can you talk about the first attempt? Like, I guess it sounds like it was an idea in your head mm-hmm. for a while. Mm-hmm. And what was the sort of the seeds of an idea? Like, is there a personal problem or sort of yep. an opportunity you saw?
Yeah, it was so this was 2005. The TLDR is I went so straight out of high school. I wanted to go study 3D animation or I wanted to work at Pixar. That was like the dream because I was a designer through high school. But for various reasons, my parents were like, you got to go follow your brother in, at Cal Poly, which is computer science. So I went there for a year in the year 2000. But a year later, I was just like, I wasn't doing a good job. Like, I was starting to fail classes. I really didn't enjoy computer science. So I dropped out and went to the Academy of Art here in the city before it was, I mean, this was like the early days of that school too. It wasn't accredited. It was all about, you know, you just come in and learn kind of classical animation, art, et cetera. So I had gone through that for a couple of years, and unfortunately that school didn't work out. But long story short, I went back to Cal Poly and got an agency job, like a job at an agency, at a web design agency, to start to pay these student loans back. You know, it was just an intern basically taking Photoshop files, translating them to HTML and CSS. And then one day I saw an invoice for the work that our team was doing for one of our clients. For the work that myself and a designer on the creative team were doing, we were probably paid, you know, minimum wage for the for just a few days to come up with a design, translate it to this like in-house CMS, and it was billed at like 100K for each, like, it was basically like this data object that was sort of the center of their like billing strategy. And I was like, holy crap, there's way more value here than kind of what we're realizing. And that's when all these things came together of, here we have a designer who was like basically creating pictures on a screen, and a developer, myself, who's like translating those pictures into a code base. Whereas in 3D animation land, these creatives are creating entire, you know, storylines, and they're animating something, pressing a button, and it goes to the screen, right? I mean, it gets rendered, it goes to the render farm, but there's no translation layer. And that's where like all of this came together of like, there has to be something that is like 3D animation software for web design, where it's like more sophisticated, more powerful, where like the creative ideas are already there. These creative designers, like, they understand the power of the web. They just don't have the right tools to harness it and to leverage it. And that's where, you know, especially like that spark was seeing the invoice. Like, it's not anything in particular, but the fact that I could see that there's so much value there was like the initial genesis of, all right, I need to build a product around this.
Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, like, not the current attempt that seems to be going so well, but it sounds like there was almost a 7-year period mm-hmm. where this idea was in your head, you tried a bunch of different times, mm-hmm. I think including applying to Y Combinator and yep. getting rejected once. That must be like extremely frustrating, but it's some, you know, can you maybe walk us through that and maybe yep. talk a little bit about what kept you going to yep. try another time?
Yep. It was, I would say it was frustrating to a degree, but also I always, for some reason in the back of my head, just felt it was inevitable. It was just like a matter of when. So every time like things didn't work out, you know, every time I had to either wind like that existing attempt down, always in the back of my head, I was, you know, to various degrees thinking like, I'm gonna try again at some point, like when the timing is right, or where when I kind of figure out the issue that kind of led to kind of winding down the previous attempt. So maybe it was like exuberant optimism, or just some idea in the back of my head that there's like there has to be a better way, and I'm gonna make it happen at some point in the future. I don't know what to attribute that to. I just like maybe stubbornness, maybe just this kind of assumption that I'm gonna figure out some way to do it, but at various times prioritizing different things. You know, like when my first kid was stillborn, I had to focus on, focus on the family for a while before all those ideas kept rushing back.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, I guess in this phase, I think a lot of entrepreneurs try it. Sometimes it doesn't work, mm-hmm. but life happens, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you have to sort of figure out a way to. Yep. Balance that also in terms of just making sure your spouse, your kids mm-hmm. Are able to. How did you manage that in that time?
Honestly, it was pretty tough. Most of the time I made the call to prioritize family. This fourth time, so pretty much every time I decided to kind of wind things down, especially the third time, when, you know, we had incorporated, we had like raised some funding, we started building a product, we had a founding team, but I had to make a decision between like, do I quit my job and go forward. And then we had some trademark issues, and basically things like slowed down to the degree where I had to take a bet, like, would I go full time despite those things and try to figure out how to like keep funding while I'm, you know, try to figure out how to grow my brand new family and support them. And I had made the call to not risk too many things, right? Just because my first daughter was just born, we were not in a great financial position. So I just decided not to take that risk, which was the prudent call at the time. And then the fourth time when we actually, this last incorporation, I think we felt, both my wife and I felt like there was enough, like we had literally 3 months of savings in terms of that's how long we could go without additional, like having to get a job again. But then what was supposed to be 3 months turned into 12 months. And we were literally on the verge of saying, all right, I'm gonna go back and get my job, and we'll get my old job back, and we'll figure out how to moonlight. And we were honestly like on that edge that by the time we launched something in March of 2013, just to show the world what we were building, it wasn't even a product that we can monetize yet. We were literally on the verge of like calling it quits. And I think we just got lucky with that timing, that if it was maybe a month or two longer, we would just not be able to sustain at that level. But thankfully my wife was like really, really supportive in the sense that this was like my life's work, right? And kind of came to the like recurring realization that if we didn't give it everything that we could always, it might take years to build back, going back to my old job, but it will take, you know, decades to kind of counter the regret of not trying, given how long I've been like trying to get this idea off the ground. So ultimately we're lucky that it worked out, but I think we were on the very, very, not even bleeding edge, like beyond the edge of probably what most people should do financially to keep like pouring everything into a startup. So.
What an incredible story. I mean, I think just hearing it makes me, I guess, gives me the feels. I mean, it sounds like an extremely tough period of time. And I guess today it feels probably like super fortuitous that you kept going and did it. But I bet at that moment it was probably super stressful.
Very stressful. Actually, it gives me the feels again. I need to go hug my wife just to remind her how much I appreciate that, you know, like the journey we went through, because she was such a big part of kind of the determination and perseverance. Because there were times where I wanted to give up and she's just like, you can give it, we can risk another month.
So you launched this in 2013. Mm-hmm. Talk us a little bit about like, how do you go from there to sort of like early signs of product market fit?
I've never really answered the question to myself of when we got product market fit. I would probably say that the clearest sign was in 2015 when we essentially turned cash flow break even. So that means like we had enough customers that were like funding our operations. But the initial signs were not like super stellar. So for example, when we launched our demo or our playground, you can still see it today. It's like playground.webflow.com to see sort of the idea of what the product would become. Mm-hmm. From that, we got tens of thousands of signups on our wait list, right? So we thought, oh, clearly there's like product market fit here. But then out of those 30,000 plus customers or potential customers, you know, we had thought that maybe we'd convert like 5 or 10% of them to paying customers. When we actually went live with our paid plans later that August, I think it was something like 50 people ended up converting to a paid plan. And those paid plans were like really cheap. So that delta of, hey, we thought we were gonna get, you know, 3,000 people at least that were gonna, you know, be paying users, to a fraction of that, was really eye-opening. And we were like, what's going on here initially? It ended up being kind of a, there was a silver lining to it. It was a blessing in disguise in the sense that those people were so, Webflow was so transformational for them that they were all in, right? Like they were so, you know, for many of them, it became like the way that they made a living. So they were like in the product, you know, 8-10 hours a day and giving us a ton of feedback. They became like a part of like the early community that wanted to help others in the same boat.
Sure, 50 true fans.
Exactly. Yeah. And we were, you know, we ended up kind of wrapping our arms around them to support them, see what they needed most. And then that slowly grew over time. But it was a pretty, you know, we had a lot of existential questions the first couple of years because, you know, we weren't growing fast enough to justify kind of like the trajectory that other startups saw, especially, you know, if you go like a seed round to a Series A, et cetera. So we, you know, had all these questions around like, are we building the right product? Is the market large enough for like the professional use case that we're building for? But I think there was enough there that we consistently had just enough confidence that, you know, we really needed to double down on this like more professional user base that is creating things often for other businesses, and kind of doubling down on that professional nature of the product. Because when we first got rejected from Y Combinator, it was like the exact reason we probably would have expected to give ourselves. Like the product was too difficult for like end businesses to understand, and it wasn't powerful enough yet for developers, like true developers. So it was just somewhere in the middle. Like you kind of had to be almost like a developer to take full advantage of the product. But the like the value was more to individuals or smaller businesses that, you know, didn't have access to a developer. So it was like this weird, you know, middle zone that we sort of fit into. And we had to decide to keep like doubling down on that core user base, because those are the only people we really knew that were using and paying for the product. So it felt like that's, you know, we had to honor that and keep investing into that part of our user base.
One thing that was unique as reading up was that I think you sort of had this like seed round, but then you went a while without raising another round of funding. Yep. It sounds like because you maybe like became cash flow positive. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was that intentional? And you know, would you do the same thing again?
Yep. Definitely not intentional from the get-go. So what happened was we struggled a lot actually in our initial seed round, even post YC. I think a month and a half into our seed round process, we had only raised, I think we had targeted like $1 million, but we raised like 350K. So, you know, like smaller angels, smaller funds. And it was getting so kind of like, the word I would use was I was distraught. Like every morning I would wake up and it's like, okay, here's another like five investor meetings where we're gonna either get no's or why this isn't gonna work or, you know, kind of not hear from them again. I remember like a conversation we had with Paul Graham, and this was like the last batch that he was involved in YC. And he was like, look, clearly it's not working for you guys to keep raising money. You're not spending time on the product. You're getting, you know, you're hearing a voice from your customers that nothing's improving because you're just focusing on fundraising. You can just, you raised enough that the three of you can keep working on it for a year, right? We had enough that we can just pay ourselves like a reasonable salary and kind of just go heads down. So when we let investors, kind of everybody who was in that process, know that, hey, we're like stopping fundraising, a few more came in. It was like, no, we're just, you know, we were kind of waiting on the sidelines. So thankfully we were able to raise that first initial seed round. It was like ended up being $1.4 million.
Funny how saying no usually.
Yeah. And we weren't even saying no in the like the FOMO sense of, we were just
not
literally
trying to do that.
Yeah. We were just like so tired. And we just said like, we're not going to keep fundraising. Like we're just going to go back to building. And thankfully that led to kind of like this groundswell of wait, maybe we want to be part of it. But then, like I mentioned before, we just weren't growing super fast. Even though we've had some conversations around like a Series A, we just didn't have the metrics. And we were burning cash to the degree where, you know, it just was not sustainable. So that's when we made the call to stop hiring as quickly, to essentially like, by virtue of survival, get to default alive, because we just didn't see a clear path to kind of the traditional raise a Series A and kind of go that same round. I think that was, you know, the non-intentional part of it, where
almost kind of a necessity.
Yeah, almost a necessity. But by the time we got to cash flow break-even, it just felt like, you know, we're kind of in control of our own destiny. Things kept working pretty well. Like we didn't feel the need to go out and raise additional funding. And then over time, that even though we weren't growing amazingly fast, it was enough, and it compounded quickly enough that we just built a pretty pretty strong business like 7-8 years later. And that's when we you know, got a lot more sort of inbound interest around partnering with kind of more traditional venture partners. And that's what led to our Series A, I think, in 2019. So what, 6 years, 6.5 years after.
Let's switch gears a little bit. Maybe talk about hiring. Can you talk about maybe the first hire you made, and how did you find that person? Yeah.
So the first hire, it was our front-end engineer. His name is Dan. It was kind of a fluke because I didn't have a big network at all. So I grew up in Sacramento. I literally only knew one other developer, and I had met him at this WordPress meetup like 3 years before. So I sent him a note, like with the intention of trying to hire him, basically asking the question, who's the best person you know that is like into front end engineering, fully expecting him to say, hey, I'm down for the job, et cetera. But he said, you should talk to this guy named Dan. He had, he was working at a web design agency, but had created his own front end framework for animation. And it was like the perfect overlap of like, hey, here we're trying to empower designers to become front end developers. And there's like incredible technical depth, like not just what you would expect from front end engineer, like building screens, working with React. Well, React wasn't even a thing at the time, but thinking very systematically in first principles around like web core principles and web engineering. So he took a bet on us, but it was like probably the most influential like technical hire we've ever made, because it's essentially in the first year had invented that wasn't even in our initial vision, like our entire interactions and animations engine that became probably the biggest growth driver for the first like 3-4 years of the company. He was at Webflow for 10 years and is now moving on to do amazing new things. But I think that was a pretty foundational hire. And it was, again, like pure luck.
Webflow is, a significantly sort of large company. How mm-hmm. has sort of the hiring processes evolved? And maybe can you talk a little bit about sort of like what you've learned specifically around like leadership hiring?
I mean, it's evolved probably 100 different ways. But I think the thing that has remained consistent is alignment to the mission. Like that is we've learned a few times that even when like skills, experience, et cetera, exist, but there's just, you're kind of foregoing this excitement around empowering other people to create for the web. And that's sort of, when that's something that's more of a side thing for somebody, it's like, yeah, that's interesting, but I'm here to do a job. That has almost never worked out. So that has remained a constant around like who, like why are people joining, and how much is the core mission and a part of the reason why they want to be part of this mission or this core team. The second thing, especially around leadership hiring, especially lately, I've been leaning a lot more into kind of leaders who sweat the details. So there's kind of a tendency, or there was a tendency over the last few years where there's more of a focus on just people management or just leadership or people leadership in terms of kind of supporting a team, empowering a team. All those things are super important, but leaning more towards the details and the craft of like the thing that you're building together, and the importance of a leader like really understanding those details to set a really high bar for not only what the team kind of creates together, but also the people that join the team, the kind of the way that the team works together is a reflection usually of kind of what the leader brings to the table. Just nothing like a leader that is like holistically is almost like a representative of the product, the mission, the vision, the culture across the entire stack, not just like one part of that.
In many, many ways, wanting sort of a builder mindset. So I think one of the things recently I've been seeing is there's been just rise in companies building in public. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you all have like a public wish list that you publish. Can you talk a little bit about like how you all landed on that and maybe like how that has allowed you to sort of engage with the community more.
So I think we landed on that pretty quickly from the very beginning. So the first thing we did was we set up a forum. This was before we even launched. We set up like a user and community forum, and we saw a lot of requests bubble up through that, but it was really tough to manage because you have many separate threads, like loudest voices usually win. In our forum before that, you know, people wanted everything. And in this wish list that we set up, we created this dynamic where you had to use a Webflow account to upvote something, and you only had a certain number of votes. So to vote for something else, you kind of had to remove a vote from you know, another area. So it almost created this like stack ranking algorithm or stack ranking effect where people really had to choose what they really wanted. And we gave the power for folks to like dual vote. So if they really wanted something, they could use like 5 of their 10 votes on this one thing to show like how much that was needed in their area. So it gave us like this really rich input into what is missing in the platform. So that's a big benefit of that. The shadow side is that you can never build everything, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times things that got a lot of upvotes were not necessarily always strategic for us, or that we would get to, you know, next, or so it didn't always represent like a one-to-one mapping between what we believed was the most important thing to build for the company. In hindsight, I would say there were times where like user insight was probably more right than what we thought was the next most important thing to build, right? Like we might have thought this would be, you know, a cool new area of functionality, whereas a lot of our users are saying like, this core thing is broken, please like focus on that before, you know, building this new shiny thing. Other times it created a, you know, a pretty a set of tough conversations between like, why is it that this most voted thing is not getting, you know, a lot of attention for years, right? So it's come with its, I would say, overall, it was largely net positive, but it had some downside to like the appearance of building in public. Whereas in some cases, we had to be like pretty honest with like, hey, we're not gonna work on this area. And sometimes the toughest one was when we would take an idea and actually devote a lot of time to it and tell our community that we're working on it, and then realize either, you know, it was too hard to build, or some you know, some business constraints or some technical constraint or some other reason why something else made sense, and to go back on our commitment was like a really, really rough series of conversations with our community many times. So I would say it's a tool like anything else, but it's not like universally perfect or universally bad, depending on, you know, it all depends on like the kind of relationship you have with your user community. For us, I think it's been pluses and minuses, largely beneficial, but also has caused some of these like rough edges in how we interface with our community.
Another unique thing, I guess, that I noticed was that I think in the early days you avoided looking at enterprise customers. And this is something that I guess sort of the Valley keeps talking about, is always move up market.
Yeah.
And I think Notion has also not done that. And so I'm curious, like, what made you decide to, you know, not do that initially, and then how did you sort of move into it gradually?
I mean, initially it was very much based on YC's advice, other advisors that we had, who essentially saw the pattern that we encountered with our first enterprise customer. This is like 2015, where you know, you're very tempted by the revenue, because our first enterprise check was something like, it was like $250K when we had maybe $1 million in the bank. So it's a material amount of, you know, revenue and cash, but it came with, thankfully we were able to avoid these strings in our first deal. But typically like the initial pressure was like, essentially we would be building our product towards the needs of this much larger company.
Yeah.
And that seemed like an existential risk. Like it seemed like it would help our business, in the short term, but over time we would lose like the special kind of early first early adopter community that was for whom Webflow was not just like a helpful part of their business, it was their livelihood at that point. We just had to make a call between, all right, our team was what, maybe 20 people at the time. And we just saw that, hey, if we keep doing more of these, it's just gonna pull us towards this direction where we're constantly at the mercy of like larger businesses to just build for what they need, while not necessarily ignoring the lower end, but just by virtue of only having so many few people, we would just have fewer people working on the needs of our core product. So it wasn't until we were probably at, trying to remember the revenue scale, maybe 25 million in ARR, that we started to legitimately started to see so much like organic demand of just existing upmarket customers who were on our self-serve plans to get more, right? Whether it was like single sign-on or account support or like deeper security features, et cetera. And that's where we started seeing it more as incremental rather than as like a replacement of our core business. So that's when we started layering on more enterprise functionality, had like an enterprise offering. And that's sort of the direction we're heading in now, where it's not like a shift to a different type of customer, but an expansion beyond our core customer base to go more upmarket. And that's been a more like natural and organic way to explore it, where we're, it's still like a relatively small part of our business, like around 20%. But we're finding ways to do it kind of in conjunction with our core product and our core business.
You mentioned there was a time when you sort of hit a million ARR. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of go back in time and sort of tell me more about that particular milestone?
Yeah,
for a lot of like younger entrepreneurs, that is like, you know, the first like version of product market fit. Like, I've gotten to some scale.
Yeah, I wonder. I honestly have struggled to remember that exact moment, because I think when we hit a million in ARR, we're burning quite a bit of cash, quite a lot of cash. Where I was just, you know, if we're, I don't know, making whatever it was, around 100K per month in revenue, we were probably burning 150 in expenses, and it just like looked existentially bad. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember seeing that revenue milestone as like a huge milestone.
So you're focused on just getting to cash flow positive.
Yeah, at that point, I was like more worried about, okay, great that we have this, but it's just like not sustainable, yeah, right? It almost felt like a vanity metric at that point, if I'm remembering correctly.
And the costs of that time were primarily people?
Primarily people, yeah.
Got it.
We had some, I would say in retrospect, some pretty bad decisions we made on things that were around like go-to-market. So I remember shortly after our seed round, maybe a year after, when we were looking to launch our CMS, which was our major like first big like product expansion, we spent, maybe we had $1 million in the bank, maybe a little bit more, but we spent 200K on this ad campaign with this famous agency that was making all the other startup videos at the time. And it seemed like a good idea. We're like, oh, we're gonna make this thing and it's gonna be super popular and it's gonna bring in a lot of business.
Like a sandwich person?
Exactly, good guess. And it was honestly, I think we used that video, you know, we thought it was gonna be funny and it's gonna resonate with the market, but it like had pretty it sort of made fun of developers in a kind of kitschy way, but it had enough like blowback that it just didn't have much, you know, business value. So we stopped using it in ads and anywhere else. And that was just a terrible financial decision, right? Like we could have hired two engineers for that, for the amount of money we spent there. But outside of that, it was mostly just hiring people and engineers and designers to,
should keep that video as kind of like a good reminder.
Totally, still have it, it's in the archive.
You know, one of the things you've sort of believe is, you know, Webflow has really helped spark this no-code revolution. Mm-hmm. And that's really transformed much of the software landscape over the last few years. Mm-hmm. I guess, as you look into the future, do you have a vision for where this goes in the next 10 years?
sort of all the trends that are coming together right now, put together, you know, no code, low code, AI, I think we're still, it still feels that we're at the beginning of this kind of democratization revolution of getting more people to create software or like benefit from the leverage that software can bring. Maybe roughly 1 to 2% of the world right now is like creating software in any meaningful way, even with like the advances in AI, while the vast majority of the world, especially the world that's online, is benefiting from software being a part of their lives. So I think the over the next 10 years, we're gonna see that that percentage hopefully rise to the, if not close to, maybe half of the degree of what, like the way that literacy exists today, right? For every person that is able to read a book, like people have the fundamental skills and to a degree, like the steps that they can take to like write and distribute a book, right? We're still nowhere near that when it comes to software development and like creation of not only traditional apps, but just leveraging software in our day-to-day lives, right? Like Notion's been a big part of creating like automation light, sort of like automating things that typically you might do manually or, but I think we're just like scratching the surface of what's possible, even with the AI tools we see today. So I think the next 10 years are gonna be transformational in that way where no matter what happens to like these platforms or these businesses, I think they're all going to be part of the story of how do you get the world to think of software as like a key thing that you use to solve everyday problems, whether they're like business, personal, or otherwise. And I don't know, like I don't have enough confidence to prognosticate exactly what that's gonna look like. But my hope is that 10 years from now, it's like a, you know, a normal thing to have a kid that is like, you know, 10 years old using software to solve like real problems or like automate things in their life or whatever, the same way that they use math today or use writing or use like Play-Doh or Legos.
Love that. I think there's a lot of similarities to how we think about sort of the future of the world. And I think there's this general push that I think Webflow and Notion is doing just towards making more people mm-hmm. like into the creation phase rather mm-hmm. than just consumption phase is
yep.
so inspiring. All right, we ask these two closing questions to mm-hmm. all our guests. So here's the first one. Describe a day in your life. How do you start your day? You know, do you have any sort of customs or mm-hmm. rituals that mm-hmm. you know you do every day?
Kind of boring. The days almost always feel different, but they almost always start the same. So I have this kind of pretty easy but challenging enough 5-minute workout that I do every morning right before I shower, and I have a gratitude journal where I jot down a few things morning and evening. And typically I'll like either drive to work or if I'm at home, like walk the dog and then settle, with, the, you know, in my home computer and my home office. But that's really the net, sort of rituals, of my life, right? Like always starting every morning, roughly the same. And I have like other workout routines throughout the week, but that has been, I wouldn't say like fully transformational, but like a steady, you know, steady thing that helps me get grounded. I've tried all sorts of like meditation practices or whatever. This is the only thing that stuck is like something physical, something like a little bit challenging, something that makes me feel healthier and like start the day on like a positive note.
And what about sort of the evenings and family time? Are there like certain time you try to get back at and you plug back in?
Yeah, evening is pretty sacred. Like my daughters are at a point now where, you know, one's going to high school, just started her first year in high school. One is 2 years away from that. So they're kind of at the point where they don't want to spend time with me organically. Like you have to do more to create that space to build relationships. After the first year, it was really important for me to create a culture at the company where like we're not working nights and weekends. And when I'm home with the family, it hasn't always been, you know, 100% adherence because there were some like tough moments, especially through the pandemic that I had to take some, you know, extra time to focus on fires. But, you know, I try to be home at like 5:36 most days where we can have dinner as a family. And that is just like irreplaceable. So to me, like family is, you know, if I had a choice between family and like Webflow going to zero tomorrow, easy choice, right? Like it's that's where most of my kind of sense of self and belonging and purpose lives, even though my sense of purpose with my work is so, you know, such a big part of my life. Like there's nothing, like it's not even in the same, family clearly wins.
So. And then the last question, if you were to write a book about what's gotten you to this point in your career, what would you title it?
Honestly, I don't know exactly what I would call it, but I would have the word empowerment in it because I've seen so much of the magic that happens when you put more power into people's hands, and especially economic power. And I think that's what's been behind our mission to how do you get people to feel like the skill that they're developing like opens up new doors for them, helps them start a new career, put food on the table, et cetera. So something about like the empowerment economy where, and I think you've seen this too at Notion, where like how much magic happens when somebody feels like they are not only exploring a tool or a platform, but they're seeing it as an avenue to bring more prosperity into their life, bring more creativity, bring more, like they feel empowered, they feel like they have superpowers. And that to me has like been the engine of our success so far. And I think will remain the engine of what creates a strong business around, you know, putting more power into people's hands.
I like that. The empowerment economy. It's a good ring to it. Vlad, yeah. So thank you so much for sharing your story. So inspiring, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us this morning.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
First Block is brought to you by Notion for Startups. We at Notion care deeply about startups and founders, and we hope these stories inspire you to keep building. To learn more about how we are supporting startups, please visit notion.com/startups.